Hey guys, this is Jennifer with This Year's Mindset, and we are live with episode 420. Got our co-host here tonight. Greg, how's it going?
Good. How about y'all?
It's been a week, but you know, tomorrow's hump day. I'm almost there. Our guest of the hour that everybody really wants to talk to, we've got our friends here, Tim Nowak and Jason Anderson. How's it going, guys?
Good. Real good.
Going good.
All right. We're going to go ahead and jump in. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about each of them, and then I want them to introduce themselves a little bit. But we have, this show is the factory winner and the senior winner, and we didn't want to make them have to do the show by themselves. So we're letting them buddy up and have a show together. So Jason won the factory division in the International Precision Rifle Federation Rimfire World Championships over in Italy a little over a month ago. And we had to wait to have him on the show because he kind of explored a lot of Italy after it. So we had to wait for him to get home and get the show straight. And then we've got Tim, who won the senior division. And also good to know that they finished 9th and 11th overall in the match. So not just, you know, won your division. They had very respectable finishes also. So that was very well played. So we'll start with Tim. Tell us a little about yourself and how you got into shooting.
It's been about 4 years ago I started shooting. Francis Colon, pro shooter and friend, got me started into the rimfire. A little bit of center fire, but I really didn't care for that too much. And just started going to matches and taking everything I could from him, information and anything I could get from him as far as gear and techniques, and then just progressed from there and just kept at it.
That's funny how you just kind of start a little bit and then you get to where you do it more and more and more, and then all of a sudden you're going to an international competition.
Yep.
Just kind of happens. It's kind of funny the whole time over there, you were just like, yep, I'm just going to shoot. Like it's another day. You didn't seem nervous or anything.
Yeah, the first day was pretty relaxed. The second day of shooting was pretty tough for me. Really tough. A lot of pressure.
You didn't let it show. Jason, how about you tell us a little about yourself and how you got into shooting?
Well, I've been shooting in some form for most of my life. So I've always done it, whether it's hunting or I did prairie dog hunting when I was young. Otherwise, shooting cans with BB guns, pellet guns, that type of thing. I started shooting competitively, I think it was 2015 or 16. I picked up some, or I went to I don't know, it was like a little trade show type thing, and they had a booth for three gun, and it intrigued me. And so I picked up some gear and started doing three gun, and that got really expensive and time consuming, even when it was just Courtney and me. And I don't remember exactly where I found out about rimfire, but I went to a match, actually got squatted with Justin, my very first match, and shot terribly. But I got hooked. I want to say this was like 2018 or 2019, maybe something like that along those lines. Got hooked, and there's just so much about the shooting precision rifles that it's like really works well for my brain. Like being an engineer, it's like there's so many numbers and there's data and everything. So it's I really took to it pretty quickly.
Makes you happy.
It does.
I can laugh. I'm the same way. I like data, and like it makes me happy to have my data card with all my stuff on it.
Yep. I love the Kestrel, the computers. I love that stuff.
That's right. So how did it feel? I want y'all both to answer each of those, and I don't care who goes first. How did it feel to get to represent the United States on an international stage?
To start with, it was really nerve-wracking because you know, you didn't want to be the guy that took, you know, didn't represent the U.S. like in a top-notch level as far as finishing. So you always had that pressure there. So once you, once we got to Italy, it's like, wow, this is pretty incredible. And to represent the USA was beyond dreams. I mean, you watch the Olympics and it's like, you know, how do these people feel? And it's an awesome feeling to represent your country.
Yeah. You, the comment you made about the Olympics, I got a lot of people ask, you know, is this an Olympic sport or will it be? But yeah, it is really hard to put into words for me what it was like. Nerve-wracking for sure, to your point, like you don't want to disappoint, right? And everyone's expecting you to do well, especially in a shooting sport being the USA. And it was really cool though at the end of the day, after, especially after it was all done, I'm incredibly grateful to be able to be part of Team USA. I mean, I can't imagine many people in this world or in this country get to be part of Team USA, or anybody in the world gets to be part of their country's team for any sport. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. And one of the highlights is watching our flag go up to the very top and just hearing the anthem. And it was just like, wow, this is awesome.
That was great. I think the opening ceremony was neat too, watching everybody march in and everybody was proud and, you know, waving the flags, and that kind of was like a get you right here kind of moment. And I wasn't even shooting for Team USA, but just being an American, I was like, oh, I'm so proud of them. Look, and that's before y'all even started shooting. So,
and the little man with the flag.
Yes. I actually, it was cool because I think some of my favorite pictures and seeming what seems like a lot of other people that I've showed the pictures to or seen the pictures, favorite pictures are from the opening ceremony.
Yeah, there were a lot of good pictures there. Everybody was fresh, not tired.
Yeah.
Right. Ceremony, a lot of people were really tired.
I was, that's for sure.
Yep.
I was wore out.
Me too. I was smoked. So let's talk about the match itself for just a minute. There were lots of stages. I want to hear from each of you what your favorite stage was, what your hardest stage was, and what your easiest stage was.
The hardest stage was the first day, was the tank trap, just because I couldn't catch up to the wind. I took a 2 on it and I'd shoot left, miss, shoot right, miss, center. I just couldn't catch up with it. I guess the ones I like better were where you shot like at level ground and then you shoot up at top of the mountain. That was kind of cool. You know, it was different. All the props were solid. I mean, there was no issue of wobbliness or anything. And that was pretty solid.
What was your easiest stage?
All the ones I cleaned. I don't know. There's, to be honest with you, all the stages were, I guess you break it down into 4 parts. They were all easy as far as course of fire. Mm-hmm. And they were all easy for, you know, shooting off from, you know, putting your bag on, they're solid. Third part is the wind was the hardest. I mean, it was changing, you know, left, right, going clockwise, counterclockwise. That was the toughest part. And then the last was the pressure. The first day you didn't feel the pressure. The second day after you find out where you're at, the pressure sets in, and it was a lot for me. I couldn't get steady. It was too much.
So did you watch the scoreboard or not watch the scoreboard?
Did not watch it. I, even back home at matches, I don't, it's, you know, Francis Cologne always said, hey, one shot at a time, one stage at a time. It's, that's it. You don't worry about the rest. Even back home for like normal matches, I get so nervous, wound up, and it just gets to me.
Jason, what were your favorite, hardest, and easiest?
My favorite stage. Actually, to be honest with you, I thought about this because I was asked this a few times. I think my favorite stage was probably either the boat or the pontoon, just because it was unique. I mean, it's not too often you get to run down and you get to shoot across a little body of water and then transition way up onto a hill and shoot more of a high angle shot. So just in the fact that it was unique, in terrain and prop wise, I'd say that's probably my favorite. My hardest stage, I'd say this one is in the running for what ended up being my favorite stage, but it was the ladder. I believe it was stage one or very near stage one. I stressed about that stage for so long. Honestly, I didn't even really think much about many of the other stages because that stage encompassed a lot of what I know are my weaknesses as a shooter.
I think y'all all stressed over that stage.
Yeah. So I generally can do pretty well, but so let me describe that a little more. So it's a ladder, right? It was a ladder with multiple rungs. You had to shoot off of two shots off of each rung or each of four rungs that were designated from top to bottom. They weren't that wide. They were certainly narrower than I would say a standard ladder from NRL 22. Would you agree, Tim? I don't remember exactly off the top of my head how wide they were.
It was a little bit narrow. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did know from the height they were set at that they weren't necessarily strong heights for myself. The targets weren't close and they were over open air. I mean, they were open air backdrop and it was open air on the way there. So there wasn't very much to give you any indication what the wind was doing. And on top of that, after breaking a shot, if you didn't see where your trace went or catch side of your bullet, you were out of luck. So combine the prop and then it being a higher round count, one of the 12 round stages with a lot of movement on a prop that I wasn't super strong on. I was really worried about it. And I went back and forth like days, talked with other shooters about how I should shoot it. And shooting factory, I'm a little bit more gear restricted than the open folks. And the way I would have shot it, I couldn't shoot because of gear restrictions. So it was like all these things were stacking up and it was like getting in my head. And then Paul Dallin actually came down maybe two or three shooters before I started and we were talking. And he brought up a point on how I should shoot it along with, I think it was Russ from Canada. And I'm like, I'm just going to go that. I'm doing it. I'm like, I'm just late. Last moment stage plan stage change. Also not a great idea. But I did it anyway. And I shot, I think I might have tied for I got 10 points on that stage, which might have tied or just under stage winner for that. So it worked out well. I shot well. I started with a wind call and it worked and I stuck with it and ended up being one of my favorite because of the feeling like you put so much effort and you think about it all the time. You stress over it and then you shoot it really well, if not like one of the best in the whole match. That feels really good. So that has to be maybe tied for my favorite. Also hardest. Easiest. Probably one of those 50 yard bay ones. I was lucky to be able to shoot them at the end of the day, so they seemed really easy because everything we were shooting, like no wind, everything was close. So there's probably some of that too, but Yeah, probably one of the 50-yard bay ones. Should I answer all those questions? I think I got them all.
Yes. You did. So since I already asked him this, I'm going to ask you, how much pressure did you have to perform at this match versus others? And did you watch that scoreboard or not?
Yeah. To Tim's point, I think we're a little bit opposite in the sense that when I shoot two-day matches, so far in my shooting career, first days have always been terrible, just absolutely horrible. I wouldn't say my first day was horrible at Worlds, but it wasn't good. It was crazy. I've had nerves before matches before, where especially I wanted to do well or perform. But I've never been like really, truly nervous before at a match, and I was, especially on that first stage of day one. It was a new feeling for me to actually be like really, really jittery and nervous. So I didn't like that, but it got better throughout the day. I ended up standing in the sun too much, which didn't help things. And I ended up, even towards the end of the day, I was feeling better mentally about everything, but I couldn't get my heart rate under control. I'm drinking water, but even standing in shade. So that didn't help me either towards the end of the day.
Probably from staying on that hill.
Yeah, that didn't help.
Yeah,
walking up and down that thing.
And even just standing, you know, I notice a lot of you guys are on glass, which feels like this. So like you're standing on one leg pretty much half the day. It was a bunch of fun.
Yeah, I actually didn't think much of the sun, but I guess we were in the Mediterranean, right? Or really close to it. So I really underestimated what the sun was going to do to me on the first day. I wish I would have paid more attention to that.
Mm-hmm. Dude, I got sunburned.
Yeah, I think most everyone got some amount of sunburn.
Yeah, but by the end of day one, we were toasted. We were sunburnt, dehydrated, exhausted, cranky.
Yeah.
Just ready to get back to the Airbnb full of awesome peoples. So we'll start with Tim on this one. Was this match different than matches that you've shot in the States? And if so, how?
I don't know if it was, it's different just because you're representing the U.S. I guess that was the biggest thing. It's pretty much the same. I mean, every match I go to, I'm nervous. I'm, you know, it's just, I don't know. I wouldn't say it's that much difference except for, you know, representing the U.S. And then you have, you know, a lot more people, you know, watching U.S. shooters, like, you know, pulling for you. So, you know, that's added pressure. But as far as different, as far as the match goes itself, I'd say it's about the same.
Jason?
Yeah, I mean, the core part of the match is the same, right? You're shooting off props at targets based off of a stage description. The environment wasn't, I've never shot a match with so many skylined targets, so that was a little bit different. I've also never shot, I don't know if I can say I've ever shot a match where all the props were as solid as they were there. I think Tim made a comment to that. That was really nice, to be quite honest with you. Outside of that, yeah, the only thing I would say that was maybe really, really different is the pressure aspect was definitely there for me way more than anything I've ever shot in the U.S.
And the thing about the match there is you didn't have any gimmicks. It was like based on the shooter making the shot. Your win call, your dope, your basic fundamentals had to be right. And there was no like, you missed this because of a wobbly barricade and the target was janky or whatever. This was set up for you to make the shot. And if you didn't, you're not going to get the point. You know, it's, you know, so the next person, his fundamentals are good. He'll go through it and make the shot. So I really like that part of it. You know, it's more based towards the shooter and not some gimmick prop going on.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I agree. I should also say one thing that was different, way different than I didn't think of right away. The way they did a two-day match. So I'm not sure if everyone that wasn't there is aware of this, but you didn't shoot back-to-back days where all of my experience with two-day matches here were back-to-back. You shoot Saturday and Sunday. I think that's pretty much the case with every match I've shot that's 2 days. But the way it was there was it was 4 days of shooting, but each class only had 2 days of shooting. And those 2 days were separated by a downtime day, which was interesting. Never shot a match like that. I wasn't sure what it would be like mentally. I really liked it. I'm super happy that was there because, number one, walking up and down that hill to the sun, it was really nice to have a day where I could kind of get out of it a little bit. I stayed around a lot to help with some just, you know, support of the open shooters, but I could stay in the shade or move to the shade or get out of the sun whenever I needed to. So that was nice.
Yeah, I agree with Jason. The day off per se and the hour and a half lunch, I loved it. It was like recoup. I know a lot of people didn't like it. They wanted to just keep rolling, but boy, if I could have every match, you know, a break like that, oh, I'd love it. And the other thing that was really awesome is they had ROs for every stage.
Yeah.
And that really takes a lot of load off shooters.
Agreed. It's, you know, especially at a match of this level, like I understand that, you know, your local one day is like dedicated ROs is probably not going to happen unless those matches get really expensive. But at something at such a high level, it's great to have a good set of, you know, really good ROs that are dedicated to that stage because they're going to do so much better of a job than any other option. And the ROs they had, they were all super passionate about what they were doing and were trying their absolute hardest to be the best ROs they possibly could. It was great.
Yep. Awesome.
So let's do a quick...
Oh, I was going to just say that's a stressful job in itself, doing that for 4 days and, you know, the world championship. I think that would be a pretty stressful job. I wasn't jealous of that. That's for sure.
I've ROed 2 days before and your eyes at the end, you're just like, oh, I can't concentrate. It's not your eyes so much as like concentrating and like, don't blink, mm-hmm. You know.
Mm-hmm. The longest match I've done is 3 days. And like by the end of that, I'm just ready to nod with my eyes for a solid day. Like I'll go function at work. You're going to have to read stuff to me. I'm going to walk around like this. So let's do a quick gear rundown and talk about what you guys shoot, what you guys love. Jason, we'll let you start on this one. And also if you could tell us a bit about what factory class actually means for those of our viewers that don't know.
Okay. So I shot, I'll see if I can do this systematically. So I shot an Anschutz 1710 competition. So it's an Anschutz 54 Sporter action with, it was a stainless 20 inch barrel, a 22 inch barrel, and then MDT ACC chassis. I shot it. My scope was, it's a zero compromise 5-27 with the MPAC 3X reticle. SkyPod. I feel like I'm maybe missing some things. Like, do we want to talk about like all the other gear with it, like bags and everything too?
I mean, we don't need to know everything, but that's all. Whenever we have winning shooters on here, that's something that a lot of our newer shooters that are listening, they want to know, you know, what just won the world championship. So
got it. Yeah. So factory is restricted in the sense that you basically, it's like production. It's really similar to production. They had approved rifles. You couldn't add any accessories. You weren't supposed to add any accessories that would add meaningful weight to it. So there was some things like you could add an elastic band to hold an extra magazine. For in the case of On Shoots, right, they have the smaller Savage style 22 magazines. I could run a level, you can add a scope base, that type of thing. But for example, like you couldn't add an ARCA rail to a gun that didn't come from the factory with an ARCA rail. You couldn't add internal or external weights. You couldn't use a plate. There was some restrictions on how you can attach a bipod to the gun. I'll be honest, I don't remember all the details. I thought it was if you don't have an ARCA rail or a Picatinny rail, I think you got like a 3-inch or 2.5-inch section that you could add to it for use for a bipod. But yeah, otherwise you're pretty restricted. It was basically you get to shoot with the gun. The point was you buy a gun that's from the factory and you shoot with that gun, right? You don't add a bunch of stuff to it. So it made the choice of the gun really important. And also I think it by looking at a bunch of the other factory shooters, like really very personal, right? So I was like, what is important to that shooter? I mean, honestly, and for some of the European shooters, I'm sure it's just what is easier to access. What's the best thing they can access the easiest? Because there was a good amount of On Shoots there. I saw a handful of folks shooting the MPA production or factory rifle. I think, if I remember right, the Australian guy who came second, I think he was shooting a Bergara. I could be wrong on that, though. But yeah, otherwise there was a mix of other stuff. Savage, one of the guys that was shooting factory with me from Britain was shooting one of the Savage rifles. And I was actually talking with him. And balance for him was important. And you could tell like that one would have balanced a little bit more. But yeah, so for me, it was important to have something that was going to be number one, first and foremost, utterly reliable, like the most reliable rifle that I could bring. And I know I'm sure everyone knows all factory rifles have their quirks, right? So I just chose the one that I felt most comfortable working through and, you know, getting everything, you know, ironed out. There's really nothing severely wrong with it. It's just like I wanted to go from like really high reliability to like utter 100% reliability no matter what. And I had no function issues whatsoever that wasn't self-induced in the match. I had one issue where I set the gun down a little bit too aggressively, and I pushed, when it pushed forward, the bolt actually slid forward a little bit and half fed around, and so I had a double feed. But other than that, no ejection, no feeding, nothing, no issues whatsoever. So that was of utmost importance to me. Everything else after that was just figuring out what I wanted.
So is this a rifle that you've been competing with previously, or is this a rifle that was...
I picked it up April or something. April, I don't even remember. It was six-ish months from before we left. I was gonna shoot the On Shoots their new 1761. I wanted to shoot their APR, but I think it was called the APR, but that I don't think that got approved in time, or it wasn't approved. So it was going to be their Woodstock silhouette version. But 10 round mags were up in the air about being ready. And so I didn't want to go through. I thought that would have been too much of a handicap. So,
yeah.
And of course, that gun and that action, those mags are really thoroughly understood by a lot of the other On Shoots shooters around here in Minnesota. So I could lean on everybody and their experience to get everything, you know, running at 100%.
That makes sense. Brett wants to know how the 1710 comp balances without extra weights in it.
Not amazing. But it's not bad. Like it's easily, I mean, obviously I you got to work through it. I had to adjust my grip a little bit, where I relied a lot more on my support hand grip, which led me actually to kind of changing my bag. I normally ran bead fill, just standard bead fill and a game changer, and I was messing around with that, and bead fill in, what is it, the size, I can't, is it the Schmedium plus one or something in between the OG and the Schmedium, and then I had a sand filled Schmedium, and I found that having sand fill and something really good firm to grip on and to really leverage a grip on the bag with the front of the gun made it a lot more manageable.
That seems to be about the most popular bag combination out there is the Schmedium or the plus one with the heavy sand fill.
Yeah.
I guess there's a reason for that. It wins world
championships. Yeah. It's my go-to bag now. I've gotten really comfortable with it. I didn't like it before just because of the weight. Not that it, well, I mean, it's heavy, right? It's a sand fill, but it does seem like you really need to be super you got to be really aware of how you take the bag off and put it on props and how you settle things. Because if you have it set a little bit weird or wonky, when that sand fill, it seems like it doesn't settle as flat for me. So I just had to be really aware of that.
Yeah, it took me a while to make the changeover. I started off with an OG and was loving it. And everyone's talking about the Schmedium, and I tried it. I was like, eh, but I just wasn't used to it. And then I shot one whole match with the Schmedium. I was like, okay, yep, I get it now. I get it.
Yep.
So, Tim, how about you? What's your setup?
I shoot a Voodoo Gen 1. With a factory Ace barrel, 18 inch MPA hybrid chassis with the ultralight buttstock, Trigger Tech primary trigger, Night Force rings, send it level, Armageddon pint sized bag, and I use a Night Force attacker. 7x35 second focal plane scope.
So why the second focal plane? Just that's good, or?
It's cost effective, it's cheaper. If I ever get out of PRS, I can use it for ELR and or for deer hunting as well. So it's just, you know, a lot of people can't believe I use a second focal plane scope, but it works.
Yeah, I mean, the scope definitely does its job, that's for sure. You know, it's just a matter of, I guess your brain probably runs a little bit quicker than mine. I would definitely mess something up with any sort of variables in there.
Well, the thing is if you talk to most shooters, they always dial. And so second focal plane, it doesn't really matter. The only time is when you do holdovers, and most of the time you never adjust your zoom. So with the Night Force, you put it at 17.5 and you have all the numbers there for your holdovers. So there's two sets of numbers, a big set of numbers for when you're at 17.5, and then the smaller numbers is when you're at 35 power. So as soon as you look through it, all you see is the big numbers, and I rarely dial. I mean, I hold over everything just because it's faster.
He's a beast.
He's a beast. Yep. I know someone that once shot a match using all holdovers.
I did. I had done three gun and I had never done precision rifle. And when I went to my first match, I was terrified to dial my scope, because in three gun, you don't dial your scope. You hold over because it's fast, right?
Yep.
So I'm like, I'm shooting this whole match and I'm scared to death. It was an MPA match when they had the small ones before they did the bigger ones. It was a one day and I'm out there shooting all of them. And I'll never forget, I shot this stage and actually did pretty good on it, because I had no clue what I was doing. And Mary Olivier said, dial your scope down, because the last target was, you know, at 1,000 yards or something. She's like, dial your scope down. And I was like, it's down. And she's like, no, you need to dial your scope down. And I was like, but it's down. You have to put it back to zero. And I said, it is on zero. And she's like, you just shot a 1,000-yard target. I said, I didn't dial. And she goes, why didn't you dial? I was like, because I'm scared to. I was so scared I was going to get off and not get back. And so then they had me out for a practice day, and they were like, dial your scope. And I dialed at a 600-yard target, and I got down there and put the crosshairs on it, pulled the trigger, and ping. And I was like, oh, that's like cheating.
Way easier. I mean, I think Tim's scope use is a great example of the fact that you don't need the absolute latest and greatest for everything. You practice with what you have.
You need reliable and highly functionable and skills.
I think the key is, you know, you take somebody's advice, try it, and if it works, go with it. If it doesn't, try something else. You know, it's like, you know, like I have a hard time figuring out how factory guys shoot their factory guns. You know, it's like, wow, it's off balance. It's this, it's that. And I'm like, it's, you know, most of the scopes you look through are like Coke bottles, because they have to, you know, back here in the US, you know, there's only so much money for scopes. So it's like, man, this is looking like through a tube, so small. And my hat's off to all the guys and gals that shoot factory. It's amazing how well they do.
Yeah, it really is, because of, you know, good clear glass goes a long, 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 long way. I done got
it.
So we're about at the midpoint of the show. Remember, if you're watching us live on Facebook, ask any questions you may have in the comment section of the video. We'll ask it live on air. Other ways you can catch us, you can always check back on the Shooter's Mindset Facebook page. The videos stay up there forever. We usually upload to all the podcast apps the night after the show. And then finally, everything eventually ends up on the Shooter's Mindset YouTube page. So that's a great place to look up past episodes. Also, if you're gearing up for hunting season, you're going to want to listen closely. We've got an offer to tell you about that could score you up to $750 in gear. This amazing promotion is brought to you by our friends at Christensen Arms. If you don't know Christensen, they've created the first carbon fiber barrel back in 1995, and they've been making world-class rifles ever since. Now through October 31st, when you buy any eligible Christensen Arms rifle, you can send their team a simple form with your original receipt. Once they've verified your purchase, they'll email you an electronic gift card code good for up to $750 on their online store, which is stocked with premium and accessories from Christensen, as well as other amazing brands like Leupold, Mystery Rants, Half Face Blades, Uncharted Supply Company, and more. Go to christensenarms.com to learn more and take advantage of this incredible offer.
All right. So how was it shooting with people from other countries? Like, it was really neat to kind of sit on the outside and watch the interactions that were happening. There were some language barriers. Some were not language barriers. You know, some did speak English. But how was it shooting with people? Because most of you were the only American on your squad. So you were shooting with people from South Africa and Australia and Great Britain and all that. How was it shooting with them?
It was awesome. It was like being back home. Everybody's friends. It was very enjoyable. Got to meet some awesome people. We all got to help each other trying to do wind calls or how to work the barricade, you know, what bag, this and that. You know, the Canadians were, you know, always buddies around. The guys from Poland, they were super awesome. Shout out to Bart. I mean, I got to go to Poland and hang out with those guys.
Bart's fun.
Yeah, the South Africans, man, it was just awesome. It was a really, really good time with them.
Jason?
Yeah, I agree. I was, that was actually one of the things that I think we did shooter profiles for Team USA. That was actually the thing, one of the things I was looking forward to the most was shooting with other people from other countries in, you know, in this discipline. And I agree with everything Tim said. It was at first, I think the first few stages, people were a little bit gun shy, like what should we share? What shouldn't we share? Everyone was trying to figure out, you know, what it was like shooting with other people from other countries. And by a few stages in, we had, our squad was the same. People were sharing wind calls, like suggestions on how they would shoot that stage. People were sharing gear, you know, where needed. People were helping each other. The other thing that really blew my mind was how many people from other countries came to Worlds to shoot for their country with so little experience in comparison to what we had. So like I was helping some folks with their reticles and understanding, you know, what everything meant and what are good increments to change for wind calls if you don't get first round impact, stuff like that. So yeah, it was really cool being able to talk with everyone. And it, I agree, it felt like Tim said, kind of like back home. Everybody was super nice, inviting, no issues. Everyone was helping each other spot. Yeah, it was a great time.
I was floored by the number of people that cheered for each other, even when it was not their country. Like I've said on the other shows, it was kind of like golf, you know, like we have the Masters here. So I've been to the Masters and you'll be sitting on one hole, like watching, and you'll hear this eruption, like on another hole. And you're like, well, I wonder what just happened. Like the same thing was happening. Like yeah. We were like up the hill and then down the hill on the tank. All of a sudden everyone's cheering and applauding. And we're like, what just happened? Who was that? What'd they get? What'd they do? You know, yeah. Wanting to see what it was. And it was really neat. So Jason said that you helped some shooters out with some tips and advice along the way, like wind calls and all. Tim, were you able to help any of the other shooters out along the way, or did any of them help you with any tips or advice?
Oh yeah, it's you know, once you start clearing a couple stages and stuff, people are like, hey, what are you gonna do with this or that? And then it just kept going back and forth, you know. It's like I would ask, they would ask, and then my off days of not shooting, I would try to help Lily out with wind calls and go down the line, talk to the other shooters and figure out what's going on, what they did, what Lily did, and kind of pass, you know, the info down the line. And unfortunately, the winds were so switchy, you know, from one shooter to the next. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of took it with a grain of salt, like, okay, it was, let's say, straight up. Just kind of wing it and go, you know.
It's funny you mentioned that, because when our squad became more comfortable, there was a lot of exact wind call sharing, and people quickly found out that it wasn't worth much, because to your point, I mean, how often did you shoot a stage and you're watching things go and you would even switch the direction that you're holding wind? I know there's many stages that I started with a left wind call and finished with a right wind call. I know there's stages I started straight up and I'd be at half a mil by the end of the stage. So I told people that too. I'm like, you know, take it with a grain of salt. You kind of have to pay attention to what things are doing. And what it ended up doing was turning into a conversation more about, okay, here at this stage, what were you paying attention to for wind indication? So that came up on a whole nother thing. I think it was with Bart, actually. We started talking about how to read Mirage. It was, I think Boyd was there, Bart, and I can't remember the other. I think it was another Polish team member. But we were telling him, you know, what are you looking for when you look for Mirage? And, you know, what does it look like when it goes left? What does it look like when it goes right? That type of thing. And, of course, I'm sure you remember, what was it? The middle wind flag in the hill. They ran on that short 49. Yep. Was target 10, if I remember right?
Yep.
Target 10. Yeah, the target 10 wind flag just became pretty much the sole source of information for good wind information on that range. That and Mirage, those are the only two things I ended up listening to. I completely ignored wind flags at the targets.
So 10 was the only one that was right, because I know a lot of them were liars. Like, I'd be sitting there, you know, I was doing the target cam, and so obviously I'm not shooting, but I'm sitting there watching, and all the targets had a flag on them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting there watching, and the flag's going one way and they're missing off the other. And I was like, that's really odd.
Yeah, the back flags are too far because, you know, your shot's already there, so it has no effect.
Yeah, the closer the wind call is to the muzzle of your rifle, the more accurate the call is going to be. I remember Emil talking about that at Expo, and it makes sense. You know, if you change something 1 degree when it's 100 yards from the target, you're going to be way, way, way off. If you change it 1 degree when you're 1 foot from the target, you're still going to hit the target.
Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of help from Lily on wind calls. You know, when I get up there, I have my idea what I want to shoot. And I go back to Lily and I'm like, all right, what do you think? And either she's agreeing with me or gives me something new. And I normally go with what she says because she can read the wind a whole lot better than I can.
It's the young eyes.
Yep.
We got...
What's that?
Yeah, Daddy's talking to some friends. You want to say goodnight?
What's that?
Don't you remember them from the Airbnb?
Yeah. Hey!
Why?
You don't remember? Greg and Jennifer? Yeah? Okay. You want to say goodnight? Oh. Goodnight.
Night!
Goodnight, buddy.
Goodnight.
Yeah. All right. Sorry about that.
That's all right. John has a question for you, Jason. What division did you shoot in Three Gun? He remembers you winning something when Three Gun Nation came to Minnesota.
Yeah, that was probably the regional. The regional that was at Forest Lake. Man, that was a long time ago. But I shot limited. Oh gosh, what was it called? It's been a long time. It was basically where you were, it was limited, I think. Or 1X optic on your AR, no optics on your shotgun, no optics on your pistol.
That's the one I shot also. I forgot.
Is it limited or what was it? Because I think they call it, didn't like Three Gun Nation call it something different than Minnesota Three Gun Group? I don't remember. I can barely remember what I had for dinner last night. So I'm like, that was 5 years, 6 years ago.
Not that old, Jason.
I know it's only going to go down from here. I'm like, I'm going to be stuck in a padded room pretty soon.
Yeah, it gets worse.
So what was it like getting prepared for a match like this? And I guess kind of the skills wise. So what kind of practice did we do? I know, Jason, you were practicing with a brand new gun. How did you guys hone your skills for this match?
Yeah, I kind of started from scratch. Thankfully, a lot of the fundamentals, they do really roll over, right? It's fundamentals are the fundamentals, you know, managing your gun on a prop and trigger control and, you know, breaking good shots, watching where things go, keeping your pace slow or fast, but not too fast where you're losing information. That all stays the same. It's just a matter of learning a new gun. Honestly, the trigger was one of the hardest things to get used to because how light the Onshoot 1710 trigger is. I've not measured it. I made it as a no joke. It is the heaviest I could possibly get it. And I bet you it's like 8 ounces. Maybe 9 ounces. It's so light. So that was really hard to get used to. It was also really stressful at first because I didn't want to ND. That's a great way to, you know, ruin a really expensive trip to Italy.
Yeah.
So I put a lot of effort into becoming really familiar and comfortable with that. As far as practice, it is it was a this year has been extraordinarily busy for me, and like we had a baby in January, so dealing with getting practice time, and then on top of having a toddler, like you just saw, practice time was pretty limited. So I ended up just shooting a lot of monthly matches. I didn't even really get to shoot any big matches. I did some dry firing, not nearly as much as I should have or could have, I suppose. I honestly felt a little bit unprepared going into it. Nate Kramer and Michelle put on a practice day for some of the buffer, some Team USA folks that were around. So it was, I think Lynn Bigelow came and Justin and Ruth and Tyler and myself. So their house is incredibly cool. So they have basically a 200-yard range out the back porch. So they set up a bunch of targets and props, and Nate made some stages for us. It was really cool. So that was a great way to finish out my practice time before we left.
How about you, Tim?
Lily and I practice every Wednesday night. Rain or shine, doesn't matter. We're out there. We tried to practice a little bit on the weekends. Biggest issue is, you know, having enough ammo to be able to practice and be able to shoot Italy and nationals and matches. So we're kind of limited on that. But on our practice time, we would set our scopes up to the highest magnification we could. And we would go, from 100 yards out to 200 yards, we'd only use like 1-inch or 2-inch targets. So we kind of condense, you know, searching for targets and getting steady with the high magnifications to try to hone our skills down a little bit more.
That's crazy. 1 or 2-inch targets at 100. That doesn't sound fun to me.
It gets you to, try to get down to, steady as possible. And I know a lot of people that show up on Wednesday night and they're like, this is insane. And I'm like, well, you don't know what's going to happen in Italy, and it works out. So
it seemed to work well.
Yep.
So how about logistically getting over there? I know just trying to get over into a foreign country with your gun and your ammo is difficult. And there was a whole thing about that. And then also, Jason, I know you brought your whole family. Leo is there and Sam, mm-hmm. and you had a toddler and a baby, and you and Courtney had this, them and a gun over there. So how was that logistically?
We got a lot of help, thankfully. We had help getting to the airport and everywhere. We actually landed at Rome right when Boyd, Justin, and Ruth came, and so they helped move some stuff around. If it was just us, it would have been so hard, but honestly, we got a lot of help. People from the Airbnb, all of the shooters' mindset, everybody at the Airbnb helping watch the kids or entertain them when we were doing other things or distracted. It was hard. It was really hard. I'm not going to lie. It was much harder than I thought it was going to be. The time change, getting the baby on the new time, and the toddler on the new time. Leo ate a lot of melatonin gummies. Let me put it that way.
He liked to come in the laundry room when I was doing laundry because he thought I was
That's right. That's right.
In the dark, he would see dark hair and he'd come over and, Mommy, I'm like, shh, don't wake up the baby.
Yeah, it was an experience. I'm really happy we did it that way, because we'll have a lot of cool pictures and videos and memories from that with everybody there. It was hard though. Yeah.
How about you, Tim? Did you have any issues getting your gun in and out?
No, going in was fine. I had my ammo in my gun case, everything landed. opened it up. They looked at it. You're out of here. Good to go. Coming back was a lot more hassle. I don't understand. You know, if you have all the paperwork when you got there with the gun, you'd think they would just look at those papers and, yep, mm-hmm. same gun, same serial number. Okay, you're good to go. But you had to fill out separate, you know, paperwork. And if you had ammo, it had to be in a separate container. Yeah, it was just a lot tougher leaving Italy than going, for sure. But all in all, it wasn't too bad. I think there's a few things I would do different. Russ from Canada used a golf bag cart or whatever. You put all your golf clubs and bag inside a travel bag. And he used that for his rifle and everything. And that was pretty slick. So I think if I travel again, that's what I'm going to use.
Good idea.
Yeah.
I had the same experience getting in, no problems. I think we had the only issue we had getting in was we had the address. It was either written incorrectly or we took the Google address instead of the listed Airbnb address or vice, like the, I don't know, something like that. So we had to refill out one of the sheets, which wasn't a big deal. Yeah, but leaving. Yeah, we ended up missing our first, the flight we were supposed to take out of Venice, because when I was packing up my stuff, I got a little bit too lax about that. I think partly with my experience getting in there, and I got really, really sick actually on the Sunday after. And I think Justin and Ruth had COVID, and they got tested positive for COVID when they got back. So I think I might've gotten COVID at the end, at least at the end of the competition. But so I ended up packing all of my mags. So when I shoot a match, I have a little Pelican case with where all of the mags and 150 rounds fit like perfectly in the Pelican case. Things don't jiggle around, but it doesn't lock. It's just one of the like 1050 or 1060, whatever it is. And I put everything in that, and I had 32 rounds left after what I brought. And I just threw it in there, and it was all together, and I threw it all in my suitcase and went about the rest of our traveling, and I didn't really think much of it. And I had a locking case, but I threw it in, since I took everything out of the locking case to shoot the match, I ended up throwing that in another big suitcase, and I had Jason Jurish take that home, so I didn't have to carry all my gear throughout Italy. So thank you, Jason, for that, by the way. And unfortunately, so when I got to the airport in Venice, I had ammo but no locking case, and that was a huge headache. It ended up being this huge fiasco where nobody knew what to do. The police wouldn't take the ammo. They wouldn't let me throw it in the garbage. I ended up having to take a taxi to a gun store like 30 minutes away from the airport and buy a locking case and then take the taxi back. So it was like a $150 taxi ride and a $60 or something locking case to put 32 rounds in it. And then they're like, okay, now, but you can go. And thankfully they rebooked us to go through New York and went through that whole thing. I was a little bit worried going through New York, but ended up being pretty painless there.
Yeah, I would be scared to go through New York with a gun.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't too bad. I met a lot of police officers, like three different police officers had to look at it. They followed you everywhere. Like you had to basically have a police officer attached to your hip to walk around the airport with it. But it was pretty painless, at least compared to Italy, I should say.
Well, at least while he was walking around with you, did he help hold a baby or something?
No, that was a whole nother thing, because I ended up sending the kids and Courtney, because when we had that layover from Venice to New York, and we're going to New York to Minneapolis, and I just sent the kids and Courtney ahead just to make sure they could make the flight, because if they didn't make the flight, I don't think that would have went well. So
Yeah, we, bunch of us, gave a bunch of our ammo to a guy who drove to the match. And we just said, here, you can have all this ammo, because we didn't want to deal with it at the airport. And he was super happy because he's like, he got like 500 rounds. So
I bet. Made yeah. his day. Hindsight, you know, hindsight being 2020, you know, I definitely would have done something like that, given it to somebody or shot it. I don't know.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely cheaper than that approach.
Yeah, that's I actually saved that. I'm going to build like a little shadow box with some stuff, and that box of ammo is going to go in there just as a memory. Just don't be an idiot next time.
Yeah, with all the rules that, like, you know, you go and do that in our little airport here, like, I feel like you could just holler like, hey, who wants free ammo? And someone would take it and everyone would be super happy about it. But yeah, I feel like rules like that are a little bit different in Italy.
Yeah.
So what was y'all's favorite thing about Italy? And also, what was your favorite food while we were over there?
Go ahead.
I would say favorite thing in Italy was all the competitors. That was a highlight. You know, representing the U.S. was right there, but interactions with the people was awesome. Food wise, I know this is gonna crush you, Greg. The food was not good. You know, I worked for an Italian for many years, and a lot of his family and friends owned restaurants, and the food is night and day different from here to there. And the only food I really thought was really good was the croissants in the morning. And that was about it. I gotta be honest, you know.
Yeah, honesty is a good policy.
I think one of my favorite things for me was at the Airbnb, actually, with all the bunch of Team USA and Shooter's Mindset and having the kids there. The Airbnb we got was really cool. It was a giant villa. So
it was beautiful. You did a great job finding that.
Yes. Thank you for doing that. That was amazing.
That was complete luck. That was like legitimate complete luck. That was the first thing I found searching for I think I searched one of the close town names. But yeah, I'm happy we found that worked out really well. So it was really cool being able to sit down and talk with people, you know, interact with them more personally, you know, outside of a match setting. So I really enjoyed getting to know a bunch of you that way. And then for talking about food, pizza, like I do really, really like pizza, but the Italian pizza, like, it's just, I just love how they made their pizza. Yeah, it was so good. I enjoyed that.
That one close by restaurant that Boyd liked so much, they had some good pizza.
Oh, well, the cafe, or was it the one in town?
I don't know how to describe it. There's a roundabout.
Yeah, with a big parking lot?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say my other favorite thing was the coffee. I already missed the coffee there.
I enjoyed that one dinner we went to that was up near where the closing ceremony was. What was that one?
The one that we totally didn't race back from in the dark.
Yeah.
That one was.
Yeah, good. There's definitely some hit and miss spots, though. It's comparatively for the rest of the trip that Courtney and I had. Honestly, I think the food and everything was overall better there in that little town and that area than most of the other places we went.
Interesting.
So, yeah. I mean, a lot of the other places we went was really touristy, so I feel like that probably played a bit of a role, but by the end of it, I did miss the food around there. And that cafe there, coffee was really great. that bartender lady was really funny too. That was there's a sand that sandwich. There was a sandwich there. It was, I don't know what it was, like a wheat or grain croissant, and it had a little bit of sauce, and it was like a mayo type thing with fish and hard boiled egg in it. And it honestly didn't even look that good, and it sounded like doesn't sound great, but it was the only thing left. I'm like, I'll try it. And it was actually really, really, really good. It's one of my favorite foods I had on that trip. And I asked her in probably pretty bad Italian, like, how do you say the name of that sandwich? And then she looks at me and she goes, sandwich. And I'm like,
yeah. That is hysterical. Yeah.
She was pretty funny.
She was putting old Boyd in his place pretty good.
The very
first night there. That was great.
Yeah.
Gave him a run for his money.
Mm-hmm. And he's one that doesn't get a run for his money very often like that. It was great.
All right. So goals. Both of y'all have won an international title. So where do you go from here? What goals do you make from here?
I guess as far as shooting goes, I would like to see Lily win national championship. I'd like to, if she doesn't win it this year, goal is to keep practicing and get her to win top spot. So I guess that's the biggest goal.
Jason?
That's I haven't completely decided exactly where I want to go. I know I want to get better and neglected, specifically like NRL Hunter, that style of match. I've found as I've shot a bunch of matches and I've branched out of the Midwest a little bit, the field style matches, hunter style matches are really intriguing to me. I like how they challenge a person as a shooter rather than, like, I think Tim touched on it earlier, right? There's not really any gimmicky, like going into stages blind. It's just you and your equipment and, you know, racing against time. You know, it really tests your fundamentals, your ability to look at something and be able to envision and set up a stable position quickly. So I like, it's just like that next different challenge, I think, for me. So I'll probably do some focus.
Definitely do those.
What was that?
You like thinking you should definitely do those, and maybe even like Mammoth or something, because they make you think so much more on the clock versus memorizing what you're going to do. And so
I do like that.
Having to think on the clock, find the targets on the clock, figure out, you know, assess it. It adds a whole new level of fun. Yep.
I've shot a few NRL hunters, and it's really eye-opening for me how different and how it's hard, but in a different way than shooting, you know, a standard. You look at a stage description, you can think through it in your head. When you do enough of them, there aren't a lot of things that can trip you up. Like, you have a pretty good grasp of heights and stability and the types of props and distances and things like that. And then it becomes about like just the executing, like pretty much like you just pretty much have to execute perfectly. Whereas when you get into situations where you don't know where your targets are, what distances they're at, what you're shooting off of, when everything is blind, how quickly things break down. Like, you think you're a good shooter. When you shoot something like that, it was eye-opening for me. And I like that. And I know it's just another area I feel like I can grow and be a better overall shooter. So that's probably where I'll probably do some more of that coming up.
So do either of y'all plan to go for the team in 2025?
No, I haven't really thought much about it. It's tough. I mean, to go, it's cost-wise, time, I guess if Little Lee wants to go, I'd go and help coach or whatever. I think I'd probably do that to start with. I don't know about shooting.
Yeah, I currently don't have plans to pursue a team spot. Like Tim said, it's especially now after the first year, I'm sure things will get a little bit more rigorous and there's a lot more interest. I think it's going to be something that you're really going to have to dedicate yourself to really set yourself up for a good chance, because like it's so competitive here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting so so much more competitive so quickly.
And I think this is picking up, like the IPRF center fire the first year, people were like, whatever, you know, there was a little bit of buzz about it, but not much. And then while they were over there in France, people were like, what's going on? Well, you know, what's happening? And so between that and then having the rimfire kind of drum up some interest, I think there will be more people going for it.
I think so too. I know a lot of people just, you know, the first time it's hard to do it, you know, like it just kind of came up and there wasn't a lot of time here in the U.S. to set up a qualification path. So we just took past matches. And I think a lot of people would have changed how they would have shot matches in the past, knowing that they would have applied towards shooting on Team USA. So mm-hmm. I agree. I think there's going to be a lot of people who will organize their match year to make sure that they have the best chance possible. But yeah, the other reasons, of course, like it's expensive. It was really expensive. And it felt like it pretty much took up my entire year just planning for managing
mm-hmm.
the logistics and making sure everything was working, getting dope, you know, figuring out a new rifle, that whole deal.
Right. Greg, do we have any more lives?
I believe we are good on the live side.
I thought there was one question about some shirts.
Oh, yeah. Let me look that up. Where did it go?
In our chat.
I was going to say there's a chat for some Midwestern folks, ladies here, that Courtney sent me a screenshot of some questions. You want more questions?
Yeah, there is
a question. Oh, gosh.
it is going to be available to buy a shirt with your face on it.
Oh, man. I forgot about that. Yeah.
But the internet didn't.
Yeah, of course not. My amazing friend and great support, Jason Jurish, thought of you. A good idea to put my Facebook profile photo on a shirt. It was actually really funny.
The funniest thing ever. So we were trying to do a scores wrap kind of quick little live in the Airbnb. And so Jason had just won factory that day. And so I was like, well, you have to be on this with me. And he's like, what? He's like eating his pizza. And he's like, I got a what? And so we get him over there and Ruth came over there with us and we're sitting there. And Jason came out from like the creepy corner that's dark wearing the shirt with Jason's face on it. And I knew it was going to happen. Like Jason Jurish had been walking around with that shirt on and we knew he was going to do it. And I still could not stop laughing to talk.
That was pretty funny.
I haven't laughed that hard in a long time. He executed that so perfectly.
I'm glad that he came with, too. I mean, the comedic, and of course, he did it with Justin's face, too. I'm sure everybody has seen, I think, isn't it? Justin changed his Facebook profile picture to that, I think, but yeah, that was funny.
It was hilarious. So what question, did they have any real quick questions?
We talked about difficulty. How do you qualify? I don't think they have a qualification path set up for next year or next time, do they?
I don't know. Greg Bell is the president of the USPRA, and so he would be the one that would have the answers to that.
Was the little shot timer guy super annoying? And did you get all the data to nerd out on after? I think that was in reference to each stage was timed. Every stage was timed. Mm-hmm. And so they use your cumulative time as a tiebreaker. Actually, which I was like, what's the point? I mean, I think along with some of the other Team USA people, I'm like,
it helped determine first and second, didn't it?
Yeah. And also I think I was tied for ninth. Yep. Three-way tie or four-way tie for ninth?
Three.
I think I ended up three-way tie.
Yeah, I think three or four, yeah.
Yeah. So I was really surprised with how many ties there were, considering how big the match was. But as the date, we did get the cumulative, and going off of memory here, I think practice score did post your actual stage time if you looked at each stage.
I think it did as well. What are your guys' thoughts on that as far as overall cumulative time as a tiebreaker versus time for one single stage as a tiebreaker?
I think it's awesome. I think it's a great idea.
I think it shows who the better all-around shooter is versus the shooter that can shoot one stage faster than everybody else. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was about to say, what happens is people practice. So in USPSA, people practice the classifiers so that they can get good at the classifiers. And they might not be that great of a shooter, but they're really good at El Presidente. And same with PRS. You know, people literally spend hours practicing the PRS barricade because that's the one that everybody uses because it's the easiest one to set up. So you have people that are really great at shooting the PRS barricade, but maybe not that great all around shooters. And so I like the overall time. I think it's more, and also, I mean, what if somebody's like a really great shooter and they happen to have a jam on that one stage? Like, mm-hmm. I liked it.
But yeah.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, though, because you want to use all your time on a stage. And my issue is I go too fast, way too fast. And if I would slow down and take that extra 1 or 2 seconds, get steady, I might gain an impact. So ideally, you want to have a really large, you know, time, because then you're using all of it. If you go too fast, yeah, okay, you beat everybody in time, but you didn't get as many hits. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be careful where you go with it, you know? So, but I like the accumulative time because why not? It works.
Yeah,
somebody once told me in USPSA that you can't miss fast enough.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Shane has, well, two questions for you, Jason. What are your goals for the 2023 rimfire season, and what rifle do you plan to use?
My goals. This year I want to shoot mostly matches that really intrigue me, or shoot, I'll go back to matches that I had a ton of fun at. I kind of want a breather year, for lack of a better term. Like, it was a really stressful year with all sorts of things, especially the new equipment. And so kind of tied into his second question, I don't know. I've been thinking about that for a really long time since I've been back. I don't know. I'm not sure. I have an Anschutz Fortner that I've been working on. I have another one that I just got back after I got back from Italy that has been rebarreled with a Bartline Gain Twist. I'm going to shoot that a little bit. I haven't shot it yet. See what that does. I'm probably going to order an AI chassis to put that in and see how I like that. I don't know. Yeah, I really don't know.
Up for suggestions, right?
Yeah, honestly, I'm finding the more I shoot and the longer I've shot, the more reliability and really just pure reliability in every sense of the word with the action, the gun, the magazines, everything, the whole system together is becoming rapidly becoming my number one priority. Just because when you shoot matches, like to your point about having jams, like if you had one, I mean, Matt fought that, right? The Matt Steiner, he fought a few jams and some feeding issues with his gun, and you saw how fast you can fall with having one stage where you're fighting malfunctions. Even if you're crushing it and you crush the rest of the match, like that can really, that hurts you. So even if it might not be the most accurate gun or whatever, I want a gun that number one is reliable and balanced as well.
Sounds like good goals.
Yep. Yeah, you could call it that. There you go. Those are my goals.
Greg, do we have any more lives?
We are good on the live side.
All right. Well, I think with that, we can wind it down to shout outs. We usually start with Greg.
Well, I wanted to shout out everybody that made it possible for us to come and hang out in that Airbnb with you and live stream this whole match for the entire world to see. So big thanks to Masterpiece Arms for being kind of our title sponsor in that endeavor. Vortex Optics, Armageddon Gear, Hunter's HD Gold, Manners Composite Stocks, and more in scope mounts. Without the gracious support of all of them, our coverage of this match would have not been possible.
All right. How about Tim? What you got?
A big shout out to Francis Colon. Lily and I would not be in the positions that we're in the shooting world without him. Super good friend, good teacher. And then a shout out to Greg Bell, Greg Stewart, and Ruth Seuss for putting everything together for Italy. Without them, man, it would have been really, really tough. So good job for them. And then to, I don't know all their names, but the Canadians, Matt, Stefan, Dory, and John, Bart, and Poland team. Man, it's just so much fun to hang out with these guys and gals. It's really nice.
Yeah, I don't know about you. I miss everybody from over there. Like, sometimes I'm like, I just want to go sit on the patio and have dinner with everybody again. Or I want to be at the match and talk to all the fun people again. Like, I miss all the people that we were around during that. It was kind of nice. A lot of matches are just a weekend, so you don't have a lot of downtime. It was kind of nice, you know, at first I was like, oh, it's going to be forever. But having all those days, you got to hang out with people a little bit longer, and it was kind of nice.
Yeah, I agree.
Jason, how about you? Shout outs.
First, my wife Courtney, I have to thank her for putting up with a lot the whole year leading up to this world, and for dealing with the issues trying to get home. She was a trooper, so first of all, thank you to her for that. And then, like Tim said, the Gregs and Ruth, like, they put so much work into that just at the match. Before the match, getting stuff planned, answering questions, fundraising, all of that stuff. So really appreciate that. Everybody at the Airbnb who helped take care of our children. So thank you, and keep them entertained while we were busy. Let's see. The people like Lapua helped. So I want to say thank you to them. They helped us with some practice ammo. Danny and Austin at Onshoots North America went above and beyond. Like, whenever I asked for something, had questions, needed help, they like sent me a loaner gun just to get used to some stuff. Like, I can't thank them enough for the amount of work that they put into getting me everything I needed. I'm Shooter's Mindset for documenting it. I think I might have mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned this to you in person, or I thought I did somewhere, but my parents also say thank you to you because they really enjoyed being able to watch and, you know, be a part of it, even though they weren't there. So I know that they really like that. So thank you for putting all the effort into practicing and buying equipment and getting that to work. A lot of people back in the States, I know, appreciated that. So I'm probably missing people, but if it's not intentional. Oh, you know, I owe a huge thank you to a bunch of the Team USA who had off days, especially Tyler Orth and Paul Dallin. They helped me a ton going over ideas, talking about wind, like what to look for. I owe a huge part of my wind to them helping me too.
That was awesome. It was neat at the Airbnb watching the guys, you know, dry fire out the back or talk about the stages and how they should attack them. And so, yeah, a lot of team.
Oh, I also don't want to forget Zane because Zane was a great moral support, even though he was having a rough match and you could tell it was tough on him. He was still super supportive of everybody else. So I had to give a shout out to him too.
He was. Zane and Brad both came and helped us move equipment at lunch.
Zane's dad, it's not Brad. Zane's dad.
He's like, is it time to break down? What do we do? And he'd be like, okay, hold on. We got to wait to take Starlink down. Okay, now we can go. And they'd like help us wrap cords and they did all kinds of stuff. So.
Yeah, they were amazing.
Yeah. And for my shout outs, I want to echo what Greg said about the people, the companies that helped us to get over there and be able to do this. And then I also just want to shout out you two for both being great ambassadors of the sport. All of Team USA was great. And I heard nothing but good things from all the other countries that were coming and saying, like, they've been so helpful. They've done this, they've done that. The ladies love Ruth, talked about how much Ruth helped them. And, you know, were a cheerleader and really kind of kept them in the game. So shout out to y'all for not only being champions, both of you won, but also for being good ambassadors of the sport and helping to grow it. And thank you for spending like 2 hours of your Tuesday night with us when I know you've got kids running around and Tim's in the car.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. And with that, it will be a wrap for episode 420, and we'll see everybody next time.